Well, good morning and welcome, everyone. Super excited to go over another real estate investor story this morning. A couple interesting things about this particular story. And I might try to get this out of the way before we have too many people on the call. Although people are going to be able to hear it on the recording anyway, so it's not really going to matter. But I will say today's story time happens to be about a city in the Northeast. Hackensack, New Jersey. And I won't say exactly what happened, but the Broncos did play a team over the weekend. And not that I'm going to rub it in or anything, but that's all I got to say about that. So anyway, so the story time today, I'm representing with my Broncos shirt and my Broncos cup with my Broncos water in it. There you go. All right, so today's story. First, I'd like to read you a poem. It's based on a song by Billy Joel. It says, Anthony works in the grocery store, saving his pennies for someday. Mama Leonie left a note on the door. She said, Sonny, move out to the country. Working too hard can give you a heart attack. You ought to know by now. Who needs a house out in Hackensack? Is that what you get with your money? That is from Billy Joel's Moving Out. And today's story time is about Anthony. Anthony is the manager of a grocery store, and he's married to Martha. Martha is a school teacher. They both live in Hackensack, New Jersey. They've got a six-year-old son. And one of the issues that they have in their particular market is they live in a city that has incredibly high property taxes. Like if they're going to buy a property here today, I think it's like $370,000 or something like that. And the taxes on it are like $8,500 a year. Like here in Colorado, if we were buying a $370,000 property, our property taxes would probably be like, let me think about that, 0.7 times 4, probably about $2,500. So it's like the property taxes are three times as much, which means, as you'll see soon enough, they're going to have some negative cash flow on their properties, even with 20% down. Which is pretty interesting. So Anthony is a saver, as the song suggests. And I have to remind people, don't call me during webinars. So Anthony is a saver. So he has managed to save up between him and Martha about $100,000, nest egg. They're about 30 years old. And in case you're wondering how well manager of a grocery store in New Jersey and an elementary school teacher in New Jersey make. I did a little salary research for you just to make sure that I wasn't crazy. The median, the middlemost income that somebody who manages a grocery store in New Jersey apparently is $88,000 and change, almost $89,000 right here. A grocery store manager in New Jersey. And school teacher, about $68,000 in Hackensack. Elementary school teacher. So I use those numbers to base their income. So I said that combined, they make about $156,000 a year. And they're able to save a little bit more than 10% of their income. 10% would be about $15,600. They're actually saving about $20,000 per year from their income. That means that their standard of living, like what they're living on from their paychecks, you know, not including taxes, they're paying taxes out of all this, but their standard of living is about that of a $136,000 per year person. And so we're going to base what they're trying to achieve financial independence with and the number they need in order to achieve financial independence with that $136,000. And ideally, they'd like to achieve financial independence. You know, they've got, another 12 years or so before Sonny decides to go to college, moves out to the country. But they want to see if they can achieve financial independence. And they've considered lots of different strategies. And today they're going to consider, we'll do Nomad today. Let's see how Nomad looks when they're investing and they've got pretty severe negative cash flow and really high taxes. And they've got to replace a relatively high income. I mean, $136,000 per year, replacing that with passive income from real estate, it's going to take some time. You know, it's a non-trivial goal. Okay. So let's take a look at some of their numbers. And you know, I'm going to take a slightly different format today. I'm going to walk through some of the stuff and lay out the story, you know, based on like how I would input it doing this kind of scenario. So first of all, let's take a look here. I'm going to pull up his scenario. This is Anthony and Martha's scenario. I did put in their tax rate that's used for terminating their kind of depreciation benefit from owning rental properties. I assume that the inflation rate was what the Fed has decided they're trying to target. Although, I mean, who knows? I mean, we've had some very unusual times with COVID, and the government has seemed to pump some money into the economy via some of the subsidies and things of that nature. And whenever there's printing of money, historically, there's been some inflation. And so maybe we see higher than that for inflation. I didn't model that today. I used 2% is what I thought the inflation rate was going to be. So that's what we did there. And as an aside, people that are on live, you're welcome to ask questions if you want to. But this is story time. I've also assumed that the mortgage interest rate for them getting owner-occupant financing is 3.25. I have a client buying a property, and I think this must have been Thursday or Friday of last week. They called up the local credit union and got a quote for buying a owner-occupant property with 5% down, and they were quoted 2.625 with a very small premium, like less than $500, or 2.75 with a credit. So 3.25 seems high right now, although historically, if you look at like long-term where interest rates are, the numbers we're using now are really, really low. And so if I were, you know, seriously modeling this for Anthony and he was, you know, trying to say, hey, listen, do I have enough money? We would probably do some modeling where interest rates are going up as he is acquiring properties and do some kind of scenarios with that. And maybe we will. You know, one of the things I like about these story times is I can revisit characters. We could say this happened or what if this happens or how this all works out. So I think I'm going to revisit those. If you guys want me to revisit people, let me know. I think I'd like that idea. And I hope you guys like that too. So let me know in the chat window if you're interested. So mortgage interest rate, I use 3.25, even though right now it's about 2.625 for where we are. And then I told you they have a really high target monthly income in retirement. They're trying to replace $11,300 per month. That's a really steep bar for them to overcome. You know, replace that level of income, they're going to need a lot of passive income from their properties or the stock market. I mean, basically, the target monthly income in retirement comes from one of two places, either cash flow, net cash flow after all expenses on properties, and using whatever the safe withdrawal rate number you define here from the stock market account. So if you say, you know, 4% of whatever I have in stocks, that's what this number is here, 4%. That's using the 4% rule, the safe withdrawal rule for that. And so we're saying 4% of any money they have invested in the stock market and any cash flow they have from their properties needs to equal $11,300 for them to have achieved their goal of their target monthly income and retirement for hitting financial independence. So they're starting off with $100,000. Like I said, Anthony's been saving his pennies for today. And he's got 100K between him and Martha. They've been saving a little bit of money. They've got to invest in the stock market. And if you remember from previous story times, I did some modeling of variability in the stock market. Remember I did, stock market ranges from, you know, negative whatever it is to positive whatever it is with an average of about whatever it was, 8 to 10, I forget what number we actually used. And that was based on actual historical data in the stock market. Today, I didn't use that. Today, I said, you know something? I'm going to simplify this, and we're just going to assume that the stock market is earning a flat 8% per year. And so if we're going to go model this again in the future, we may want to go and model it and have the stock market returns be variable because stock market returns are variable. They're not 8% fixed. And so we want to go and use some variability to see, hey, listen, does this work out the same way every single time we run it? Or do they run out of money? Or do they have way more money than they need? And I think that's something we'd want to do to see how sensitive this is to stock market fluctuations. In this case, I sort of wanted to pause that variability and say, I'm not going to deal with that right now. I'm just going to say it's 8%. And I think that's a defensible position for someone investing in, say, index funds. Could be much lower than that. Could be much higher. I mean, the past history does not really mean that that's going to happen in the future. The past does not equal the future automatically. It's not guaranteed by any means. And so they have invested $100,000 and it's earning 8%. This is the money they're going to use to do their investments. Plus, they're saving money. They're saving about $20,000 per year. Okay. Now, properties. Let's dig into the properties because I think this is important to kind of go over. Because, you know, we do a lot of deal analysis and, you know, a lot of the Wednesday night classes and stuff like that. And we tend to be very heavy Colorado focused because I'm in Colorado and I happen to know Colorado really, 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 really well. But Hackensack was a new creature for me. I had to go look up stuff online and I found some properties on Zillow and I was able to look up some, you know, kind of get a gauge of what median might be and like what kind of properties they might be buying and what they might rent for. And so this is kind of what it is. But if you don't like my assumptions, the great news about you not liking my assumptions is you can take Anthony's story and you're welcome to come in here and you can modify any of these changes. You could say, you know, it's not 370, it's 340 or it's 420 or it's, you know, 500,000 and property taxes are not 8,500 a year. They're 6,000 a year or 12,000 a year or whatever it is for you. And rents are not what they are. They're whatever you want. And so this is a typical bread and butter property. It's in Hackensack, New Jersey, because that's where the story's from. We're saying that the property value is worth 370 and that they're buying it for 370. They're not buying it at a big discount. They're buying quality in neighborhoods that they want to live in because they're going to buy the property as an owner occupant. They're going to put 5% down. They're going to pay the PMI. They're going to live in the property for a year, at least, if they have enough down payment to buy the next one. Then they're going to move out and buy the other one. Why don't they just go and save up 20% down and buy properties, skip this whole moving in nonsense, and buy 20% down rentals? Well, turns out I did run that before I did this story, and I'll save that for another day. But I will tell you, this is better. So if you're willing to move into properties and live there for a year, it turns out it's better. But slow your roll because I'm not going over that today. So in this case, they're paying 370 for a property. I said their mortgage interest rate is 3.25, where I told you before, got clients right now getting quoted 2.625 to 2.75 for, you know, whether they're getting a small credit or paying a small premium in order to buy their rate down or get a little credit back for having a little higher rate. Doing 30-year mortgages. They're putting 5% down. And the reason they're able to put 5% down, for those of you that just kind of strolled in a couple minutes late, is they're doing owner-occupant financing, moving into the property, living there for a year, and then converting it to a rental. So they're able to put 5% down to buy the property. This allows them to buy properties faster. So one of the problems we ran into when we did the 20% down one was it took them a lot longer to save up that 20% down to buy properties, especially since their properties are not having positive cash flow, even with the 20% down. So it's not like when they buy a property, it speeds up how quickly they're getting to their next down payment. It's like slowing them down. Every time they buy another property, it hurts them. Think about it that way. Because they're buying properties that don't have positive cash flow. Because that's what's there in their marketplace. Now they could, I mean, just as an aside, right? Anthony decides he goes down this path. Maybe he buys one property and he continues to study. And maybe after buying the first property or two, he says, hey, look, you know, I like this real estate stuff, but our market sucks. And I'm not picking on Hackensack. Could have been any other market. Could have been Chicago. Could have been, you know, any markets that have, you know, really high taxes and probably negative cash flow. And he says, look, this is not a good market for us. I like this real estate stuff. Maybe we should look at investing remotely, long distance investing. And so that's a possible solution that they could have had. Right? And then they could decide, you know, we got two of these, you know, albatross rocks around our neck sort of thing with the negative cash flow. And maybe now we'll go and we'll find some positive cash flow properties in some other markets and we'll kind of like even this out and we'll have, you know, a property or two here and see how it works out. But that's not what they did. Today we're talking about them doing Nomad. So their loan amount's gonna be that 351. Their monthly mortgage payment's gonna be 1529. This is just principal and interest. It does not include tax and insurance. They do have PMI. Anytime you put less than 20% down with a couple really unusual exceptions like VA loans, you're going to have a private mortgage insurance on the property until you get to that 20%. With FHA, you're going to have it forever. PMI never goes away in FHA right now. But with conventional financing, once it gets to 80% loan to value, this PMI goes away. So the private mortgage insurance payment is an extra $234.33 per month. Now, some people say to me, you know, why don't they put 20% down and not have to pay this PMI? I should probably do a whole class on that. The answer is, in almost all cases, it's actually better to pay the PMI, mathematically. But there's probably a longer discussion on that where I could show you some math. I'm not going to do that today. All right, we'll take a drink from my Broncos cup. Closing costs, we've estimated about 2%. Might be higher, might be lower. I actually don't know. I'm not from New Jersey. Could be a little bit lower. And if so, go ahead, change this, modify it. So every time they buy a property, it's going to be 2% of the purchase price in closing costs. Rent-ready costs, we're assuming they're buying nice properties that they can move into. Not much to do on those. It's not like they're doing burr properties or anything like that, which, you know, would be another strategy. If they were trying to do something a little bit more aggressive here, they could do, if they could find burr properties to buy in Hackensack, they could do that. Or maybe, you know, and this is just another like spitballing solutions. Maybe they buy slightly outside their marketplace, right? Maybe they commute into Hackensack and they find a less expensive market in the periphery, which is what a lot of our clients here in Northern Colorado do. They like look outside of, you know, not a lot of them are buying in Fort Collins proper. They're buying in Greeley or Severance or something like that. Seller concessions, they're not getting any seller concessions. 15% of the value of the purchase price is considered the value of the land. This is used for calculating the depreciation benefit. So we'll talk about that. They're going to deposit any, they're going to take their down payment, any expenses from that all in one account. They're going to deposit any of their rent and mortgage payments and stuff like that out of that same account. You can differentiate which accounts you get things from. In order to simplify stuff, we're just doing the same one. We're saying property values are going up at 2%. When I looked at the appreciation rate of Hackensack, it looked like it was much greater than 2%. You know, we're seeing a lot of home price appreciation across the U.S., but over a very long period of time, what are those guys' names? Case and Shiller, Case Shiller Index, they actually proved in over 100 years of data that the real estate market has nationwide, and this is the problem, nationwide it has appreciated at about the same rate as inflation of about 3%. So over that 100-year period that they measured, inflation was about 3%, and the home price appreciation over that same period was about 3.1. So it was, home price appreciation was equal to what inflation was. And so in this case, I modeled and said, home prices are going up and rents, as an aside, are going up at 2% a year and inflation is 2% a year. So it's possible that their property values, Anthony and Martha's property values, could be going up faster than 2%. It's possible. Would that really help them that much? Well, property value is not really what they're using to determine if they have achieved financial independence. If they were to sell the properties, it would help them. But in this case, the property value going up doesn't actually help them with cash flow. If you think about it that way, right? You could have property values go up. If rents went up faster, that would help. But property values, since they have more equity and the property value went up, maybe they're paying down their loan at the same rate. So they've got more equity in it, but that doesn't actually impact their ability to achieve financial independence and having enough positive cash flow and money in the stock market coming in. If they sold the property, sure. If they did a cash out refinance and they took the money from the cash out refinance and they invest that in stocks, sure. Those things have an impact. But just purely property values going up doesn't actually help. Which is interesting to think about. If your goal is financial independence and you're not doing some, you know, strategy where you're taking, you know, buying 10 properties in order to have the equity grow to a point where you could take the proceeds from four of them to pay off the remaining six, or, you know, take the proceeds from selling six and pay off the remaining four in order to have four free and clear properties, that's a totally different strategy. And in that case, having this appreciation rate higher would help. But in this case, it really doesn't help that much. We're saying rent is $2,400 a month on a $370,000 property in Hackensack, and that rents are going up 2% a year, and no other monthly income on the property. We're using a 3% vacancy rate. And again, some people say to me, hey, James, why is your vacancy rate so low? You know, I use whatever it is, 10%, because I'm doing properties in Jacksonville, Florida, or Memphis, Tennessee, or, you know, wherever it is. And I say to them, one of the reasons why we use a lower vacancy rate is because we start 90 days in advance of the lease expiring to find the next tenant. And so we have plenty of time in order to find a tenant. The vacancy we have is usually unexpected things. It is not like your lease ends and you go in there and you replace paint and carpet and spruce the place up, and then you start marketing to find your tenant and it takes you, you know, 30 days or 45 days to find somebody. That's wrong. Don't do that. Please don't. You know, make sure you have in your lease that you have the ability to lease the property while the tenant is still in there. Ask them to make a decision as to whether or not they're going to renew their lease, you know, 90 days or at least 60 days ahead of time so that you can decide if you're going to find another tenant ahead of time. And that's why vacancy rate's a little bit low. Property taxes, this is like the whammy. It's like the really ugly part of this deal because property taxes are about 2.3% of the value of the property a year. In this case, about $8,500. And that's based on like a real property theft. And I looked at more than one. So I was like, whoa, the taxes on this thing are really, really high. Yeah. And then I went and looked at some other ones. I'm like, they're all high in Hackensack, apparently. So Hackensack's got some high property taxes. So $8,500 a year, $710 a month in property taxes. No wonder we're going to have negative cash flow. It's no surprise. I use 0.5% for property insurance. That's about $1,850. You know, I use a little higher than what I would normally use here in Colorado. I just thought it might be more conservative to do so. Maybe it's not this high, you know, and if use whatever you're getting quotes from your property, your insurance provider is, your insurance agent. But in Colorado, we'd probably use a little lower number, same price property, which is interesting to me because the property values are very similar. I mean, we're buying $370,000 properties as rentals and as nomads here in Northern Colorado, but they're different. You know, the taxes are not quite as high. Our taxes would probably be $2,500. I think I said that already. No HOA. We're assuming that when it's rented out, the tenant is paying all the utilities. It's not like the landlord's responsible for any of that. Let's see here. Maintenance on the property. We're assuming we're setting aside 10%, of the gross monthly rents, or about $232 a month for maintenance on the property. And we're assuming that they are managing it themselves. So property management is zero. Okay. They're self-managing. So a couple things. I wanted to talk about this because I don't usually talk about it in a lot of these classes, but I wanted to give you a thought exercise for you. And it's an interesting thought exercise for those that are trying to plan for financial independence with real estate. And your plan is to eventually have free and clear properties that don't have mortgages on. So it's hidden in the definition of some of these terms. And so give me a little bit of latitude and you're going to like where I'm going with this, even though it's going to sound a little bit dry when I'm going through the beginning. Okay. So operating expenses on the property are things like property taxes, property insurance, HOA, the utilities that you're paying if you're the landlord, any other expenses, maintenance, and the property management on the property itself. So operating expenses are all the things you need in order to run the property, any expense you have on a property, except one. The one that you are not including in operating expenses is your mortgage payment, any financing, principal and interest, okay? So we don't include that. So if you take your gross operating income, that's how much money you're making on your property after vacancy and stuff like that. So your gross operating income is like your net rent after you've taken out vacancy and stuff. So you take that and you minus your operating expenses, all those expenses on your property, and you're left with your net operating income, your NOI. And you'll hear a lot of people talk about NOI. NOI is used when we do cap rate calculations and stuff like that. But there's a really interesting thing about net operating income. And that is this. When you have a free and clear property, a property that does not have a mortgage on it, your net operating income is the amount of money you're making net after vacancy, property management, taxes, insurance, HOA, utilities, after everything, because it doesn't include your monthly payment on the property. So if you think about this, if you look at whatever the net operating income on a property, in this case, it's $1,231.87, and you just say, okay, I'm going to do some really rough math. These guys want to eventually replace, round up, $12,000 a month in income. It's like $11,000 and change. But let's call it 12,000. And let's round down for net operating income and say it's not 1231.87, it's $1,200. So if you think about that, a free and clear property is gonna make about $1,200 a month. They need $12,000 a month in order to be able to have enough positive cash flow, net positive cash flow after all their expenses when the property is paid off free and clear. How many rental properties do they need? Reminder, people, please don't call me during webinars. How many rental properties do they need that are free and clear? Yeah, Cece, you're exactly right. It's 10. But what's interesting about the net operating income calculation is you could take whatever number you need. Like, let's say you only need $6,000, and now you divide by the net operating income of what your properties that you're buying are, and it will tell you how many properties you need free and clear in order to hit your number. That's a super interesting, super helpful, like, mental tool. You can be thinking to yourself as you're driving around, hey, what's the net operating income on this property? Oh, it's this. Okay, I want to have this amount month and this amount per month. That's how many properties I'll need. And you could do that math quickly in your head. So that's kind of like the payoff for that, all that boring stuff about operating expenses, net operating and stuff. All right. Cap rate in this property, I wouldn't consider this anything crazy amazing, although it's probably about what we see here in Northern Colorado, maybe a little bit lower. 4% is what the cap rate is when they're buying these properties. Monthly cash flow, brace yourself, hold it onto my desk, -$532 a month. What? -$532. But wait. They're only putting 5% down. Isn't that great? No, it still kind of sucks. So they're buying properties that are -532. And you're thinking to yourself, why are they doing that? You know, why are they going and buying a property that's -$500 a month cash flow? I don't know. Seems a little crazy, right? Well, I ran this with them just buying stocks, and this plan is better. So if they went and they just bought stocks and they got an 8% return on their money and they saved the same exact money and they did all the same stuff, it actually is better for them to have done buying these properties with -$532 a month. And part of it is what I'm about to show you, because that's just one area of return. Super interesting, right? Okay, so let's take a look. They would have needed to make about $3,000 a month in rent in order to be break even. It's $2,400, so they'd actually need to make around $3,000 in order to be break even with that cash flow. Okay, so let's talk about this. Let's talk about return in dollars. Because I think this is interesting stuff. And for those of you that have not registered for tomorrow night's class, you should go check your email. But this is sort of like the precursor for a lot of what you're gonna get tomorrow. This is the basic entry-level stuff, and really the amazing stuff's like all down here, which I'm not gonna show you right now. That's for tomorrow, it's already done. But the stuff that we're going to go over tomorrow is all down below. So we're only going to do like the first couple. Okay, so here's some crazy stuff though. All right, so think about this. So their alternative, one of their alternatives, Anthony and Martha's, is they can invest in stocks. And if they invest in stocks, we assume that they're getting about an 8% return in the stock market. So 8% return on investment is sort of their return to beat. Think about it that way. So let's take a look at where the returns are coming from with them buying this property. So if they buy the property in year one, and the property goes up 2% in value, 2% appreciation rate, then they're seeing about $7,400 in appreciation. That's if the property goes up 2%. We really don't know what the market's going to do. And honestly, when I teach this thing in detail, I usually teach you that the top half of my return in dollars quadrant, that's the speculative part of the return. It's the part that is dependent on what the market does. The market goes down in value for appreciation, this is going to be negative. If it goes up, this is going to be positive. If you have a really bad year with cash flow, like you have your tenant destroy your place and you have a lot of maintenance and stuff like that, your cash flow could be really negative. Or if you're buying a property in Hackensack with 5% down, it's going to be negative. Or if you happen to have a lot of cash flow coming in because we have multiple tenants default and you get to keep their security deposit and you end up getting more money, whatever it is, right? So you can have years where this goes up, or if rents really increase a lot, your cash flow can increase. But the top half is market dependent. It's more speculative. It's more uncertain. It's more variable, okay? The bottom half, which we'll get to in a minute, are less speculative. They're more consistent. They're more reliable. They're less reliant on what the market conditions are doing. Okay. So we have the top half, which are speculative, the bottom half, which are less speculative. The right half, cash flow and tax benefits, that's cash now. That's cash in your pocket each month. The left side is future cash or cash in the bank. It's like long-term appreciation and debt pay down. It's equity. Okay. So the quadrants are set up visually so that you can easily see, you know, what's my kind of like cash now stuff? What's my cash later stuff? What's speculative? What's not speculative? And we can kind of see those four things quickly. So getting back to these numbers, this is like, I'm all over the place today, but you guys love it. You're following along, I hope. Okay, more Broncos drink. You know, maybe I like do the classes until I run out of beverage. Maybe that's my new rule. I don't know, we'll just see. Anyway, so appreciation. So the property value goes up 2% in that first year. You're seeing about $7,400 in appreciation. We had negative 500 and change cash flow. So it's negative $6,387 in cash flow for the year. Negative. If you look at this, between appreciation and cash flow, you're still slightly positive in the kind of like speculative kind of stuff going on. So it's still slightly better than break even, or it's not negative. That's true. On the right side, you get some tax benefits. So the tax benefits are depreciation. If we could rent this property in year one, which we can't because they're living in it, but if in theory they could rent this property in year one, or in year two, the numbers would be slightly different, but you could do it in year two because you converted it to a rental. But if we could depreciate the property in year one, which again, we can't, then what you do is you take the gross depreciation, which here's the layman's explanation of that. Go talk to your CPA for real details. But you take the overall purchase price, you exclude the value of the land because you cannot depreciate land. And what you're left with is the value of the building. You take the value of the building and you divide by 27 and a half years. And that gives you the amount of depreciation per year you can take gross. Okay. Then what you do is you take the gross depreciation and you multiply it by your tax rate. Technically, it's actually your highest tax rate. To be more conservative, we use your effective tax rate, which is usually lower. And so you take your effective tax rate, you multiply it by that gross depreciation, and you get this dollar amount. That's right here, $1,715. And what that means is you are paying $1,715 less in taxes, or that money is actually coming to you as a tax refund if you were like break even or you're already negative, or you're already getting a refund back. Okay, so you're getting an extra $1,715 per year back in the form of tax benefit. That's like net. Okay, so when you kind of add these two together, I'm going to round. I'm going to say this is about 6,000 and high change, and it's actually not high, but and this is about 1,700. So we're still negative about almost $5,000 in like real money now. And then the last one is debt pay down. How much of the loan did you pay down in principal? Or when you rent the property, how much did your tenant actually pay down? Because your tenant's paying you the mortgage payment because that's part of rent. And then your rent, you're using it to pay off. And so really, this is sort of like your tenant paying down your loan for you. When you're living in the property, you're doing it. But next year, it's really what it looks like. And so there's about $7,000 in benefits from that. What's interesting to me is the ones that are not speculative, they're not really relying on the market. You have about $7,000 in debt pay down and about $1,700 in tax benefits. If you actually make payments on your loan, you get this. It doesn't matter if the market went up or down. Doesn't matter if rents went up or down. If you actually pay down on your loan, you make your 12 payments as agreed with your lender, you got this $7,000. It doesn't matter what the market's doing. Unless they change the tax law, you're getting the $1,715 in tax benefits from depreciation. So those are like your more certain, less market reliant returns. And so between the two of them, it's like $8,000, almost $9,000, $8,000 high change. That's the return you're getting there. So if we take these numbers, and by the way, total of everything is $9,766. This is all four of the quadrants added up. But if you take these numbers and you divide by what you had to invest in order to be able to do this deal, the like down payment and the closing costs and stuff, it gives you a percentage return on investment. Crazy, right? So the percentage return on investment here shows you this. From appreciation, because you only put 5% down plus some closing costs, your return on investment from appreciation is 28%. From cash flow, negative 24%. From tax benefits, the depreciation benefit, 6.62. And from the debt pay down, 27.17. Which means your overall, you add all four of these up, your overall return on investment is 37.71%. That was my pause for dramatic effect. I'm going to even do it longer and take a drink. What I just said was you're getting a 37% return on the money you invested. Anthony is. So Anthony says, I can invest my money in stocks and get 8%. Or I can do this crazy nomad thing, which has negative cash flow, and I'm going to need to put more money into the deal because it's negative cash flowing, but I'm getting a 37% return on my money from that thing. Huh. What's going to work out better? 8% or 37%? Even though you're feeding the investment and your denominator is increasing on these. Craziness. Okay. So let's take a look at what happened here. So we're getting back now. That was going over the property. And I wanted to show you something else. I forgot to show you this because it's at the top. So this little meter here shows you how this property is performing. So you could see on here that the little line shows you where the property is. This is the section where if you had a property manager managing the property, if your green line in here means you'd have positive cash flow, even with professional property management. This lighter green area means you'd have positive cash flow if you were managing it yourself. If the little line showed up anywhere in here, based on what the rent you're getting is, if it showed up in here, you'd have positive cash flow with you managing it. If your line is in here, it means you'd have positive cash flow, but only with you managing it, but only if you take into account the cash flow you're getting from the depreciation benefit. So anything in here means that you're getting cash flow with your depreciation benefit. And this is my cash flow power meter for those of you who have seen it before. And then finally, this is the amount of debt pay down you're having. So this shows you that they're not positive with for professional property management. They're not positive if you're managing it yourself. They're not positive even if you take into account the cash flow from depreciation. But if you look at the benefit you're getting, they're still getting some benefit from the debt pay down portion of the thing. So it's not a totally negative cash flow if they had interest-only loan, which I'm not going to get into that today. I'm going to do a whole class on cash flow power meter. But that's how you look at that. Okay, so this quickly shows you visually that this property is barely positive, even taking into account debt pay down. And you can see that same meter right here. So if you want to look at your properties, you can see that this has a little bit better cash flow than being totally negative, including the debt pay down portion of it. That's why it's in the orange. And this is if you put the 20% down, it just increased a little bit. It's still not positive. It's still negative if you put 20% down. I just happen to have that in here. And so you can quickly see what the cash flow position of that property is visually. Okay. All right. So here's what we did for Anthony and Martha. They decide they're going to buy these properties with 5% down. They're going to do 5% down and they are going to... they have to have at least $20,000 in reserves. That's what they feel comfortable with. They're saying, I want $20,000 in reserve, but anything over $20,000, if I have enough for a down payment in addition to the $20,000, I'm going to buy a property. I can't buy them any faster than 1 year apart because they're owner-occupants. And when I get my loan as an owner-occupant, I sign a form that says I am required to live in the property for a year. And so they have a 12-month like limitation as to how quick they can acquire them when they're doing this nomad strategy. So they're going to buy the properties and they're basically going to buy them as they do that. They've got their expenses from their paycheck. So their expenses are $9,950 a month. Their paycheck and personal expenses, they're earning about $14,000 a month gross. Okay. Not after taxes and stuff. And they also decide once they're done acquiring the properties, they're going to keep investing the money in the stock market until they have enough to pay off a property. And they're going to pay off the lowest mortgage balance first. So once they get to the point where they've got $50,000 as reserves, plus enough to pay off an entire mortgage in full, they're going to take that lump sum and they're actually going to use that lump sum to pay off the mortgage. Why don't they take and pay, you know, an extra $200 or $500 a month on the mortgage as they go? Does anyone know? Kind of curious if you guys picked up on this. It's kind of a subtle point, but it's super interesting. I'll give you a point to start typing in. You'll get full credit if you type it in even after I start telling you. But the reason is, the question is, so C says, what's the question? The question is, why don't they take $500 a month and pay off a little bit of the mortgage each month? Why do they wait until they have the full amount to pay off the mortgage before they go and they pay off the mortgage? So the reason is, when you take that $500 a month and you pay down your mortgage, the return you're getting on that $500 a month is the mortgage interest rate, in this case, 3.25%. So they're voluntarily taking a $500 a month amount and they're voluntarily getting 3.25% on their mortgage. It doesn't actually improve their cash flow because when you pay off your mortgage, it's the mortgage payment doesn't change unless you got an interest-only loan. It stays the same for that full period of time. So even though the loan will be paid off sooner and eventually they'll have a free and clear property faster, The actual cash flow on a property does not change if you make a $500 extra payment on it. But if they keep that $500 instead of paying off the mortgage that month, they keep it invested in the stock market, what's the stock market return for them? 8%. So instead of getting 3.25% by paying off the mortgage a little bit early, now they're getting 7% in the stock market. They're waiting for that to grow until it gets to the point where they have enough to pay off their mortgage. And then in one fell swoop, they come in, they take the full chunk, they pay off the thing, and now they have no mortgage on it, and they do get the benefit of cash flow on that property. So they're like using their money instead of getting a really low return by paying off their mortgage each month. And they're actually saving it in the stock market, investing and getting a higher rate of return so that eventually when they have a big chunk, they can pay off the whole thing and then really free up cash flow. Okay, so that's what they're doing. They're paying off their mortgages, but only in full. They're not waiting and doing, you know, monthly payments on this. So what does this look like? Let's take a look. Because I can. That's why. So I'll just do a little summary. We could drill into the blueprint, but may not get to it today. So here's their net worth numbers. Kind of shows you over time. This is their account balance. I'm going to kind of walk you through what's going on here. So this is their bank account balance. And they started off with that about 100K. I'll even zoom in more. So they started off with 100K, and then they bought that property the first month. And so they went down to about $75,000 because that's what it cost them to acquire the property. So CC says the question, so you're saying delaying PMI part of the mortgages. So you're saying delaying PMI part of the mortgages. I don't think I'm saying that. I'm not sure even what you're referring to exactly, but I don't think I'm saying that. the like waiting to pay off your mortgage in full has nothing to do with PMI. Has to do with you getting a higher return on leaving your money invested in the stock market until you're ready to pay off the whole thing. Because if you pay off it in portions, like monthly or, you know, twice a year or whatever it is, you're only getting the mortgage interest rate as your return. So that's what I'm saying. Okay, so account balance. So they buy a property. They're continuing to save. Remember, they're saving about $20,000 a year. So their account balance is growing. They buy another property. So their account balance goes down. They're saving $20,000 a year. They buy another one. Saved, buy another one. Saved, buy another one. Saved, buy another one. Until eventually they get to the point where... Let's see here, where they stop buying at about year 10, month 122 or so is when they buy their last property and they've got about $24,000 in their bank account left. From here on out, they own all the properties they're going to own. They're living in one. They've got 9 rentals. They bought 10 properties total. Then they're saving up all their money in the stock market. It's getting some return, you know, 8% a year, whatever it is, until eventually they get to the point where they get about almost $300,000, $291,000 in their bank account. Then at this point, they've got enough for $50,000 in reserves, plus enough to pay off one of the mortgages, and then that property is going to have some cash flow. So they pay it off. Then they save up, and they get enough to be able to pay off the mortgage in full, then they pay it off. Save up, pay off the mortgage, save up, pay off the mortgage, save up, pay off the mortgage. And eventually they get to the point where they've paid off the last mortgage or whatever it is here. And from here, their account just grows. So they end up with the whole, at the end of the scenario, after this is 60 years, by the way, they started off at age 30, but 60 years later, that's age 90, they've got about $3.5 million in their bank account. Okay. So that's what it looks like. This is when they buy their properties. Shows you each month that they did it. And then what they paid for them. They were going up in value at 2% per year when they did that. And then here's when they achieved their goal. So it took them about 301 months in order to achieve their goal. And I'm gonna drill into the scenarios. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I wasn't planning on doing this, but what the heck? I'm not driving. I'm going to compare the 3 scenarios that I ran that I wasn't going to go over. I'm going to do it because it's fun. So I'll turn off the other ones for now, though. So this shows you Anthony saving his pennies, gets to the point where he's able to achieve financial independence, where he's got enough passive income coming in from the rental properties, plus any money he has invested in the stock market that he can take out 4% per year, safe withdrawal rate. This means that he has enough to replace that, or whatever it was, $11,300 per month in income. And yes, to answer the question that's coming next, we did adjust for inflation. So that $11,300 is actually a lot higher than $11,300. It's $11,300 in today's dollars. So we do take into account the inflation stuff. It does all the inflation stuff correctly. Okay, so basically it says it takes that long. And then over time, you could see his standard of living could be a little bit higher. Eventually, he could be taking out 30% more than what his goal is. Okay, so he could actually, it's increasing over time. Or you could think of this as being conservative, where if expenses increased or his numbers didn't go up as well as we assumed, then he'd be safe. That's a margin of safety, another way to think about that. So how does this compare? So he's able to achieve financial independence, even buying these like horribly negative cash flow properties, having to replace a very large income in a what I would consider to be a relatively hostile real estate market. I know I'm going to get like hate mail from people in Hackensack. By the way, I love Hackensack, although I've never been there. At least I don't think I've ever been there. I did grow up in the Northeast, but I love you guys in Hackensack. Sorry. It's a hostile real estate market because your taxes are like ridiculously high. I just derailed myself. I'm in so much trouble. Okay, so basically he's able to retire after 25 years. So at age 55, doing this strategy. If he had just done stocks, it would have taken him 37 years until he was 67 years old in order to achieve that. If he did 20% down properties, it would have taken him 31 years to do it. 31 years. So it's the fastest way to do it is this Nomad strategy. Now you got to ask yourself, you know, maybe you're Anthony and you say, I don't know, James, not moving into 10 properties with my spouse and my 6-year-old child, Sonny, it may be worth the extra 6 years to not have to move into these properties. That's a personal choice. You get to decide that, right? But if you want to hit it earlier, you know, what's 6 years of your life not having to work anymore? What's that worth? And you know, honestly, you can make a case, right? You can make a case that maybe Anthony stops working at 23 years and he coasts in for like the last couple of years because he's got most of the income, most of the houses are paid off. He's got most of the income he needs to retire. He's only short a little bit. And maybe he dips into savings for that last couple, few, 5 years, whatever it is. We can model that. We could say, oh, stop working at this date. And what does that look like? And we can see how that plays out. But you can make those decisions. So that's one of the things. Oh, I'll show you this too, just so you can see. So the just stocks one, that's this yellow line. And it's nice, slow and steady, 8% return on your money. And then eventually you get to the point where the amount of money you have in the stock market using a 4% safe withdrawal rate would be enough to support Anthony in retirement. Okay? That's when this crossed over the 100% line. And then at this point, he stops working. And the reason the line increased at a different rate is because he's no longer saving money and adding to it. It's just compounding from whatever money's already in there, okay? And then here's the 20% down properties. Looks similar in some ways to the curve for the Nomad ones, but it ends up being later. And part of that is because you're buying the properties later. I'll show you that. Let's see, number of properties owned. So this shows you when you buy your properties, and the yellow line, maybe hard for you guys to see. Maybe I'll zoom in. The yellow line shows you that he's basically buying a property almost every year because he only needed to save up 5% to get to this point. And so he's able to get his portfolio properties, his 9 rentals and the one he's living in, he's able to get there very, very quickly because he only had to save up 5% in order to come up with the down payment and closing costs and stuff like that. But he's able to get there faster. And basically, by the time he gets his 10th property here, he only has 5 20% down properties. So it takes him a lot longer to acquire them. It takes until month 235 in order to get to the point where he's acquired the 10. And then the stock one, we assume he didn't buy any properties. Okay, so that's all I have to say about that. I mean, you know, for those of you that have access, you guys can go ahead and look at any of these charts, or you can look at the blueprint. And the blueprint just gives you like details on every part of the story, you know, month by month, and any property that they bought, and you know, when they achieve financial independence and, you know, all that sort of stuff. Like here, you can see like what the situation looks like, what their cash flow looks like, what everything looks like. So it kind of like narrates it with story time. That's what the blueprints are. And you can go look at those. And then of course you can copy it into your account. So if you wanted to go copy into your account, you just do that button and it allows you to copy it and then change any assumptions. So that's all I got for you. That's story time. Did you guys like Anthony's story? You going to go listen to some Billy Joel after we're done here? Or should we not do this? George says, great story. Well, I'm glad you liked it. I do like the story times. I'm going to do more of these. I think I'm going to do a lot of variation. I've got a... Because there's so much variability, you know, like what they decide to do and what happens with the market. Candace likes the story too. She gave me a thumbs up. I think we're going to do more of these. Yeah, nice. Wish I could make more of the stories. What do you mean? You mean you want to actually make the stories? Oh, Nathan says, I wish I could make more of the stories. Nathan, unless you have the same name as a client of mine, you have access to all the story recordings. So let me know if you need access to those, Nathan, but yeah, clients get access to those. So he says, how do we do a copy to modify Anthony's story? Thanks. Well, if you go to the blog post at the bottom, it has a link to copy it. You literally click it into your thing. And provided you have an account that allows you to copy, you just click confirm copy and it literally copies the whole thing in there and then you change it. So, Nathan says, make it to live class. Yeah, live. And George says, I am new to Northern Colorado Real Estate Investing Group, but this was extremely informative. Oh, great. I'm glad, George. Glad you're liking it. Cool. Well, that's all I got for you. I may go grab myself some breakfast. That's the type of dog I is. But I hope you enjoyed it. And I will try to get the recording up. Ken says, very informative. Yeah, I really like these. I think they're good. And they're varying enough that I don't feel like I'm teaching the same class over and again. Missed the first 5 minutes. Does this group cover the burr strategy? George, if you are in Northern Colorado, it's going to be hard for you to burr. Possible, but very, very challenging. Or specifically nomad. We do a lot of nomad stuff because it's one of the strategies that works well here. Brady says, good story. Is it at all possible to find loans for new buyers? Is it possible to find loans for new buyers? Yeah. I mean, there are lots of first-time home buyer loan programs. I mean, conventional 3% down, conventional 5% down. If you're a veteran, 0% down, VA loan. FHA loan, 3.5% down. Yeah. George says Fort Collins. Yeah, it's ridiculously hard to do a burr in Fort Collins right now. Our market's super hot. So it's hard to find the properties that you can get at a discount period. So in today's market, yeah. I mean, you could totally get loans for first-time home buyers. We're working with a client right now, first-time home buyer buying a property for the first time, and they're getting a loan. CC says, so one key learning is that paying PMI could be better than 20% to avoid it. When does this break? I don't have a rule of thumb for you that says it breaks at this point, but if you run it, like make a scenario, just like I showed you today, make a scenario where you're doing Nomad, if you're willing to, and make a scenario where you're doing 20% down, and you're not moving into properties, and see which one's better. The bigger challenge, CC, I'm pretty sure Nomad's always going to be better because you're buying the properties earlier, unless you have a declining market. In a declining market, I could see you just may be lucky with timing where you're waiting for a market and then the market recovers, but we really don't know what's going to happen with any market. What was I going to say about this though? You said 20%, when does this break? I think the bigger discussion, CC, I think this is where I was going with this. The bigger discussion is whether or not you're willing to move into properties. If you're not willing to move into properties, then you're going to have to wait to save up 20% or do something creative like the burr strategy or, you know, off-market creative financing type deals or something else other than that where you're not moving into properties. But in this case, I think that the question is going to be whether or not you're willing to nomad and move in or not. Because I think that's the bigger question for most folks, right? If they're willing to do that, the Nomad numbers look better, just period. So that's probably all I got. Thank you, everybody, for attending. I do appreciate it. And I will probably do some more of these. And, you know, I might do some more where I just show you the blog posts and the numbers. And maybe I'll do more. I don't know. I'm trying to still figure out what I'm going to do with it, but. That's all I got for today. Hope everyone has a good day. Don't forget to RSVP for a class tomorrow night. Tomorrow night's class is going to be amazing. It's going to be a total game changer for all of you. Everything you learn about deal analysis, including what I went over today, is wrong. And I will show you that tomorrow night for the first time. I've been holding back, waiting for tomorrow night to show you my newest stuff, where I go over like why everything we've been doing is wrong. And you will see amazing stuff tomorrow night. It's going to be awesome. So make sure you go RSVP for that. Check your email and we will go from there. Thanks, everybody. Have a great day. I will talk to you all soon. I'm going to end the webinar. Bye-bye for now.